He's going to talk about what the long-lasting effects of the populist movements in Germany are on mainstream politics, and what effect some of those movements are going to have on politics, even if they're not coming into power or take over, you know, the state. All of them are going to give a short intro, and then we engage into discussion with you as quickly as possible, so you can ask all the questions you have. And I would hand over to Nivedita right away.
If it's okay, I would like to stand. As I said before, I have a PowerPoint, which should work now. Yes. So before I start, as usual, I have to say I have very little good news to share. So maybe I should change the issues I'm working on, but it's not fun what I have to share. And I will show a few photographs that are really not nice to see, but I think it's good to have an idea of what these movements actually even look like. And before we start with what's sort of new in the last 2 or 3 years, I think we have to remind ourselves that we have an old party, that's the NPD, that exists in Germany since 1964. It's called National Democratic Party. It's very clearly linked to NS ideology. There is little doubt on that. They were most successful in 1968 in Baden-Württemberg, that's in West Germany, with 9.8%. And then actually they had nothing to say for quite a few years, but since 2004 they're coming back. In Saarland they had 4% in 2004, in Saxony 9.2%. There was a proceeding to try to prohibit this party in 2001 that was not successful. The last election they were under 5%, most votes in East Germany, again maximum votes in Saxony, in some areas of Saxony up to 20%. And this is like the last election. But one can say they're sort of losing ground because we have other parties that came onto the ground, but they are still there. The other people who are still around is this whole sort of, well, we don't know if it's a movement or a party or what they were, the NSU, the National Socialist Underground. What happened was that in November 2011, a woman called Beate Schäpe reported herself to the police. That's the first part of the scandal. She reported herself to the police, so the police was not successful in finding her. And let the police know that two guys, Uwe Mundlos and Uwe Bernhardt, had committed suicide. And apparently this group has killed 10 people, all of them migrants, plus one policewoman who was not a migrant. The court case is still going on, plus one bomb attack and several bank robberies. The real scandal is that we actually do not know of how many people this group actually consisted. They sort of carry on saying, we're just the three of us, but it's actually not really possible that three people had the logistics to do what they did for so many years. And the bigger scandal is that we have very clear evidence of institutionalized racism in media, but also in the police. Because what happened was that these murders took place in, I think, 7 or 8 different cities. And in all the cities, all the policemen and women reacted very racistly. So they basically always presumed that because Turks were killed, the murderers have to be Turks. So there was very little sort of searching investigation in the right-wing movements that existed. The role of the Federal Office for the Protection of our Constitution is very unclear in this whole dilemma, especially the branch, again, in Saxony. As I said, the court case is still going on, so this is sort of not new, but it still is present, so I thought it makes sense to start with that. What is new is basically, or just like one more sort of sentence to, before 2013, till 2012, we had many small groups like pro-Germany, pro-Cologne, etc. One and only issue was anti-Muslim racism, anti-Muslim propaganda. They were not very successful. In 2013, this new group came up that is called Alternative for Germany, AfD. Their first issues were actually anti-EU, and they were very social Darwinist. So that was sort of interesting. And the guy who sort of founded this group is a professor. His name is Bernd Lücke. He and a lot of his supporters left the party in 2014. And after that, the party has been very successful. After that, the party has been openly racist and in some cases also openly anti-Semitic. So there has been a change in 2014. And at the same time, in October 2014, a new group started called Pegida. It's Patriotic Europeans Against the Islamization of the Occident. The interesting part is if you ask the people who are part of this group, what is the Occident? Some of them don't know. If you ask them what is actually a patriotic European, they don't know either. So there's sort of a self-representation that has very little to do with the people who are actually on the streets. And since 2014, these two groups are clearly cooperating with each other. I'll come back to the groups later, but there are two other small groups that are somehow troublesome. One is called the so-called identitarians. They exist actually since 2012. They are very different from the other groups because they have a very academic presentation. So like their core idea is ethnopluralism, which basically means they acknowledge diversity but connect this to regions. So basically they don't mind that people are from India, from Kenya, from Uzbekistan, as long as they stay where they come from. So that's sort of the basic idea. The aim is very clear, separation of ethnic and cultural groups. They insist on what they call their right to difference. They are very clearly anti-democracy, very clearly anti-Muslim. They are very clever when it gets to anti-Semitism. I checked the internet for quite some time to find sort of some sort of link to anti-Semitism. They try not to look as if they would be anti-Semites, but I don't believe they are not. They are basically young, male-dominated East and West Germans, very well-educated and digital natives, which makes it very much more dangerous than other movements. This is what it looks like when they go on the streets. I don't know, can you see the picture, sort of? And what they did last year was they climbed up the Brandenburger Gate. So this is a sort of movement they are involved in that says, protect borders, save lives. The other group is sort of bizarre, but still quite dangerous. That's called the Reichsbürger, so citizens of the Reich. They believe that the German Reich still exists according to the borders of 1937. I mean, I'm not joking. This is honestly what they believe in. Luckily, they don't accept the state of Germany, so they refuse to pay tax, have their own ID cards, but they do accept money from the state, which is sort of interesting. But because they don't pay taxes and stuff, they are in trouble with the police regularly. So there is some sort of control, because if you don't pay taxes, you are in trouble. If you don't accept any law, you are in trouble. So there is some sort of investigation on them. There have been cases of policemen being part of this movement, which is what was in Bavaria. And in May 2017, the state believes that this group has 12,016 members, 600 of them are extreme right and own weapons. So this is not a group we should neglect, I think. Predominantly in Bavaria, Brandenburg, and Saxony-Anhalt. This is what their own passports look like, just to sort of give you an idea. They basically, they just don't agree that Germany exists. So now let's get back to Pegida. I think Pegida and AfD would be sort of what we would be talking about later. Originally, they were very clearly right-wing, with Nazi groups openly and very successfully sort of going on the streets. And they were very successful in expanding to reach out for people in the mainstream society. The problematic is that they demonstrate on Mondays since 2014, and Mondays, sort of the term demonstrations on Monday is a term that people in East Germany used before 1989 because they would go on the streets on Monday too. So they're basically instrumentalizing a totally different movement. The role of media is quite problematic, and apparently now the media has decided not to report if they still meet on Mondays. They are continuously meeting on Mondays, but the media is not reporting anymore. Speakers are regularly arrested for incitement to hatred and so on, so they have problematic speakers. Interesting part is that their self-portrayal is that they are in a tradition that they call Christian Jewish Occidental tradition. Sometimes on their demonstration you will see flags from Israel, people sort of, you know, with flags of Israel, but anti-Semitism is certainly an issue in this movement. Basically, the people who are there are East German men who are employed. So this is not people who are unemployed. So it's not sort of people who have reason to be scared or whatever. They are not religious, and they're not individually unsatisfied, but they are unhappy with how things are. So that is, I think, also a big difference. And the motivation is unsatisfaction with the political system, criticism towards media, fundamental reservation towards migrants, and so on. And just to give you an idea of these pictures, I apologize for this picture, but I think one needs to see it, oops, before you actually understand. The word they have created is not refugee, but repugee, which is, I think, a very clear picture, not welcome. And sort of this is one of the demonstrations that take place every Monday. Okay, I would like to end with AfD and what I think are the core elements of right-wing populism. It can be, you know, not only AfD, but I think they're a, like a classical right-wing populist movement. They clearly declare to say, we are the people, in German, the Volk. This is not an empiric statement, but actually a moral one. So there's no numbers. It's just they feel they represent the people. And again, they are sort of instrumentalizing the slogan of demonstrations in summer 1989 in the DDR, where people said, we are the people, and went on the streets. So they're using the same terminology again for their aspects. Again, their self-portrayal is they're not anti-Semitic, and they're actually trying to catch for votes in Jewish homes for old people. Because they sort of tend to believe, because they're anti-Muslim, every Jewish person would vote for them, which is obviously not the case, but they're sort of trying to catch for votes there. Some representatives and some issues are very clearly anti-Semitic. It's when they talk about circumcision, about meat production sort of laws, it's very clear. It's not only anti-Muslim, it's also anti-Semitic. They're against the establishment, whatever that is, but some of them come from the CDU and the FDP, so are or were part of the establishment. They have a distance towards professional journalists. I believe the word Lügenpresse has made it up to Trump. So this is like one of the Germans' words people know internationally. Unfortunately, so I think I don't need to explain this term, but it's basically sort of a total criticism or distance towards anybody who's professionally a journalist. And they're trying to restrict the rights of press during their party convention, for example, that happened last year. They are clearly anti-pluralistic. Vulnerable minorities are being additionally discriminated. They're fighting what they call political correctness. They continuously sort of state the breaking of taboos. I think that's something that all populists do, and it's a very interesting way of how they do it. They go three steps ahead, then they say, oh, sorry, that we really didn't mean that. Then they apologize. They go two steps back, and the result is that mainstream media and parts of the CDU take up on this issue. So they're basically very slowly expanding sort of the floor for what is, you know, what is okay in mainstream society or whatnot. And they are asking for direct democracy, but only for those who are already anyway allowed to vote. They are explicitly racist and anti-refugee, obviously, but implicitly, and I think that is something we should not forget, because the racism is so blunt, but they're implicitly anti-feminist. They're very, very sort of, I mean, traditionally anti-feminist, very restrictive on sexual and reproductive rights. They are also against, they're anti-LGBTI rights, implicitly, but explicitly they say we are not, and one of their spokeswomen is an open gay woman. They are anti-environmental protection, and they are also still social Darwinists. And the AfD is quite clearly, they have many people who are very clearly anti-Semitic. Just to give you an idea of a few posters, the left one says, the LKA, that's the German police, warns you, the Ramadan has started, Muslims might be, how would you say, leicht reizbar? They were easily provocable, is what the left poster says, and it's Professor Dr. Meuthen. And this one you see sort of a young couple, apparently a gay couple, and quote, my partner and I don't really want to meet Muslim migrants for whom our love is like a death, Sünde? Sin, yeah. Then they have this poster that clearly says, stop, and this is a very interesting word, Frühsexualisierung means early sexualization. Basically, this is a term that people use to avoid that children learn at school that sex is not only heterosexual sex. So it's a very right-wing term. So this is something they are sort of using. And this is interesting because they clearly say we are not NS, we don't sort of follow the NS terminology, but ideology. You see one poster is from the NPD that says we are not the social Sozialamt. We're not the social welfare office of the world, and basically the poster says the same. So they do not use sort of same ideology, but terminology, but they do use the same ideology. And maybe I'll stop at that point, because successes is, I believe, what you'll start to talk about. Okay, thank you.
Right. Well, thank you. I was supposed to talk about the AfD, about the background and history, I think you started a little bit, but I see it more from a political perspective, trying to see who votes for AfD and why does it happen in Germany with that history we have. You shouldn't have a populist party. But at the moment, we're going to have parliamentary elections on the 24th of September, and I looked at the latest opinion polls, and it looks like they're going to have 8 to 9% of the vote, which means they will be above the 5% hurdle and get into the German parliament, which is a first. And I think that's why we need to take this really seriously and not try to just blame those people, because obviously they're homophobic, they're anti-immigrant, they're terrible, but also try to look at why do people vote for them. And I think that's what I'm trying to do in my current work, and it's quite difficult to pinpoint towards this direction. Just to go back to the history, I think what is really interesting about AfD is that it's not the typical NPD Nazi party. They started they were called the Professor's Party. So it was started by an economics professor, which means that, of course, they're talking to the left behind people, but not only, you also have very educated people voting for them. And they started with the Euro crisis, which was also a subject which is not typical of a populist party. They moved towards a more nationalistic wing in 2015 when Germany took in a lot of refugees, more than most European countries. And they started with a few scandals you were talking about as well, trying to get lots of media attention. And I think you mentioned it as well, it's really dangerous because then you have a shift in what becomes socially acceptable in media. That means that they have scandals, media take it upon them, it's very sensationalist, but it's still there, and it becomes acceptable to say, for instance, that one of the national football players, that was like a great story, I need to tell it quickly. It was during the European Football Championship, and one of the party members basically said that Jérôme Boateng, everyone likes him because he's a football player, but no one wants to be its neighbor because of his skin color. And it was a huge scandal, but it made headlines and it worked out. What we shouldn't forget as well is that AfD has lots of strongholds. I mean, Germany is a federal country, so it's really important what happens at regional level. And at the moment, they're in 13 state parliaments. So they have this kind of groundwork. It really works out. And they earn 24% of the vote in Saxony-Anhalt, which is one of the former eastern states. Looking at who votes for AfD, that's the biggest issue, and I'm still trying to find out what happens there, because there's no clear picture. You would think it's the white, old, male, uneducated person who would vote for them, but it's not. You have different socioeconomic classes, you have educated people, you have young people, as we saw with the Identitäre. What you can see is that you have non-voters voting for AfD. And if I can put in a recommendation to maybe decision makers in the room, is that you would have to vote to talk to those people before they start voting for AfD. And the second thing, which is very interesting as well, is that they talk to minorities in Germany, such as the Russlanddeutsche, which are the German citizens with Russian migration backgrounds. And ethnic Germans, yeah. And they're 4.2 million in Germany, and they really managed to kind of get this group out and see them as a group to talk to. So looking at what is different and what is similar to other populist parties, I looked especially at France and the UK, but also, of course, the US. I think in their program, they're quite similar. We talked about it already. Their methods are quite the same. It's the typical post-factual politics, using social bots, trying to influence people, lying. They see also people as one entity, which is really really dangerous, because they pretend there's no diversity within the people, and the popular sovereignty is just based on this. I mean, it kind of takes away the legitimacy of citizens if you're not like them. And they play into the typical politics of fear, this anger, this frustration people have. So that's the typical thing. I think it's for every populist party. What is different, though, is their background. As I said, it's a professor's party. The fact that we still have an issue in Germany with the East and the West. I mean, you do have people voting for AfD in former Western German states, but you can see the 24% at state level in Saxony-Anhalt was a former Eastern German state, and I think it has some kind of consequences. You can see that you have more people who vote for extremes in the former Eastern German states. And what is typically German as well is that they insist on that people breached rules. That's really interesting, because, for instance, during the euro crisis, they said that they were breaching the stability pact. So the lazy Greeks were breaching the stability pact. That's really bad. Or, for instance, during the refugee crisis, they were saying that Schengen has been put out of order. Right. If you try to explain what's happening with the AfD in Germany, because I still don't understand it. I mean, we have quite a good constitution. We have democracy. We have safeguards, such as the 5% hurdle. We have quite a strong civil society and quite a balanced media, I'd say. But it's still a breeding ground for populism. And it's hard to explain, but I think you have a few factors playing into it. And I'd like to come to that by trying to explain maybe the root causes and at the same time giving some kind of recommendation on what we can do. So I've got four. The first one is economic factors. I think despite Germany being a relatively wealthy state, you do have economic inequalities. And I think that means that we need to take those seriously who have the feeling of being left behind. And those who can't see maybe the advantages of having a diverse world, because not everyone was very privileged and could see, I don't know, study somewhere and be like, oh, this is great. So I think we need to see that. The second one is that not all AfD voters are economically disadvantaged, but they have this kind of cultural feeling that they are going to lose out. And it's more difficult. You can't have concrete measures to combat that. But I'd say that politicians need to provide a more positive vision of the future and maybe bring a bit of hope. And that's also an implicit criticism of what I would call consensus-based politics or technocracy, because it's two sides of the same coin. You have technocracy and populism both making a lack of politics in the end, because you don't have political debate where you can discuss different ideas and have, yeah, just have a debate, basically. So you would have to provide alternatives, not for Germany, but maybe provide alternatives for in the democratic realm. And in the end, I'd like to maybe make a point about the media again, because I think it's really important for the media to strike a balance between isolationism on the one side and confrontation. So that means you would have to inform citizens about what populists are doing, but at the same time not provide a platform for them to be populist and say lies and post-factual politics in the end. Yeah. So that are my four recommendations.
Hi. So in Germany, we don't need the AfD in parliament or as a part of a coalition government to have AfD policies. It's not as bad as in other countries. We see it in Britain, for example. The British were so afraid of the UKIP that they ruined their own country. The French are about to institutionalize the emergency laws. So we're not there yet in Germany, but the politicians, the mainstream politicians, are really scared. They tell me that themselves. For example, I met the foreign minister, Gabriel, and he said, we politicians are aware that the German people is not as liberal as we hoped. And so I think there's a lot of frustration and resignation, and the only way most politicians see is to talk like populists. It's not as bad as in other countries. Like, for example, in Austria, the conservative hopeful and foreign minister, Kurz, who's a very young guy, he speaks like a hardcore AfD person. But they have the populists, they're very strong. They are at 30%. The AfD in Germany is only at 8%. But what he says resonates very well, for example, in the Bavarian leadership of the Bavarian Conservative Party, CSU. So Seehofer, who's the party leader and the prime minister of Bavaria, he likes Kurz very well. And he likes also Orban, and he likes Putin. So there's a continuity in populism, and he applauds Kurz's idea to introduce in Europe the Australian model. The Australian model means you take the refugees on an island, you put them there, and then forget about them. And they should stay there. So these kind of ideas, they echo. They also echo in the foreign minister, in the foreign ministry, and they echo in the interior ministry. The populists in Germany are only not as strong as in other countries because the economy is so great at the moment. But there is a lot of reason to really be scared and careful. And the politicians, I think, they make all the wrong moves. Instead of convincing the people of other politics, they copy the populists. And this has also really concrete impact on laws already, on policies. For example, Germany has introduced its toughest asylum law ever. That means if you have only subsidiary protection, you're not allowed to get your family to Germany, and family unification is a human right. So this is a violation of human rights. Then they introduced a very tough, the so-called BND law. BND is the German Secret Service, with wide surveillance power. For example, if you're a foreign correspondent in Berlin and you also write about Austria, the moment you leave Germany and you are covering a story in Vienna, the BND can spy on you. And in order to do that, yesterday the parliament agreed to a bill that allows the BND to put malware, spyware on your computer and on your phone. They send you, you get a little link from someone, you click on it, and then there it is. And they can use your camera on your iPhone. They can use the microphone to listen to what you say. Your technology becomes a spy instruments. And we also see politicians toughen up in their talk. The Minister of Interior, when he speaks about refugees, it doesn't sound much different as somebody who would be from the AfD, but also the opposition. For example, Martin Schulz, he said the other day after they lost tremendously in the state of North Rhine-Westphalia, he said, we should expel all criminal foreigners immediately. The party whip, Oppermann, he said, the ships from Libya, the refugees on the ships, the migrants, they should be sent back on the sea. Don't rescue them. Just turn the boats around. They should go back. And even the Green Party, Boris Palmer, he's very, very, he's the mayor of Tübingen, and he's an important figure in the Baden-Württemberg Green Party. He's very, very, very tough on refugee laws. It has also impact on foreign policy. For example, Egypt. In order to convince Egypt to contain refugees from coming, Germany has done a security agreement with one of the most human rights abusing systems, regimes in the world. That means they sell spyware, they train soldiers and security forces how to use high-tech appliances and weapons and so on and so forth. The EU-Turkey deal is something like this. The Europe and mainly Germany is paying billions to Turkey in order to keep the Balkan route, the Aegean route, the refugee route there closed. German policy, of course, benefited from this very much. No new refugees are coming, or only in very much smaller numbers. And I say benefited, I mean it ironically. But that's why politicians, diplomats are closing their eyes Also, they know that human rights abuses are in place, of course, in Turkey, and that people are still suffering on Greek islands, sick people, people with disabilities, mostly women and children and old people who want to come to, want to go to other countries where their husbands and sons and uncles and dads are already. There's a push to establish refugee camps, massive refugee camps in North Africa. We try to contain this. I'm involved in regular advocacy meetings with our foreign ministry, with the Ministry of Interior, and the Chancery, and it has some positive impact. But I'm sure as soon as we stop doing this regular advocacy and stop publishing op-eds, we would see a very much tougher policy than we see it now. Okay, I'm stopping in a second. Just one more example, the deportation of Afghans. Absolutely unnecessary. The Ministry of Interior wants to deport 1,700 Afghans. Every plane, which leaves every now and then with 20-something Afghans, makes huge headlines. There are demonstrations against it. And that is also a place for the Ministry of Interior, because whenever this is in primetime news, they signal to their conservative voters, look how tough we are. It is worrying, and populism is deeply seated, as we heard also by our previous speakers, and I did a little bit of research the other day. I was shocked what I found out, that more and more teachers are turning to the right-wing parties, and they tell their pupils, their students who have Turkish background or Arab background or African background, that there's no need for higher education for them. They're fine sitting at a supermarket and putting milk in the shelves. And yeah, I want to stop here. I'm looking forward for your questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much to all three of you, not only for the insightful and comprehensive introduction, but also to in such a disciplined way stick to the time limits that we agreed beforehand. That's not for granted. Before we discuss with you, so please, you know, all of you who have questions, you know, assemble your energy to ask it in a minute. I would like to abuse the privilege of sitting at the table to ask a first question to each of you, just a very short one, trying to challenge a little bit some of the things you said, and then we open to the audience. Nevedita, you talked about many of lesser known movements and organizations and in Germany, so lesser known in the outside of Germany, and my concern with that is that you know, you might have painted a darker picture than necessary, because many of those are fairly small and weak and more organized crime or criminal organizations than political movements in a way. And as you know, a good naive German who believes in state institutions, I would say, you know, that our rule of law apparatus is taking care of them. But then you would say, yeah, but you saw what happened to the NSU. And so my question to you would be, do you have any kind of evidence or observation whether these kind of criminal movements are supported, shielded, or protected in some form by systematic racism, discrimination in the security forces and legal organizations in Germany? That would be my question to you. Sophie, you talked about the roots of populism in Germany, and you mentioned economic weaknesses of some of the supporters, media activities, and others. I would say that might be true for many other countries where we have populist movements, but not for Germany, where we have very strong political parties, we have an exemplary economic situation with a low unemployment rate, we have fairly good mainstream media, we don't have Fox News and Russia Today. So I think we are safe, just to provoke you a little. and Wenzel, you talked about how even though the parties do not get elected into parliament or into power, even into government, some of their thoughts
kind of seep into mainstream politics. And I would agree with that. My argument would be this is simply a proof for the fact that we are lacking something very important in the German political system, namely a political party within the democratic spectrum right of the CDU-CSU, which has not been there since 1949, or 19 more. There was one at the beginning, but then, you know, it disappeared very quickly. And do you think that maybe if the AfD loses the racist ideology and the kind of blatantly undemocratic part of their programmatics and kind of goes back in a way to those roots of, you know, nationalist, anti-European, right-wing movements that they came from, whether they would fill a gap in the political spectrum of Germany that might be needed to be filled in order for the mainstream parties not to turn further to the right and unbalance the political system further than a small disturbing factor would be at the fringes of the spectrum. It's a very kind of winded question, but I hope I made it clear. So if you wouldn't mind answering those questions from left to right, and then we open to the panel.
How much time do we have for the questions? But seriously, like a brief? Okay. Well, then I would sort of want to answer with a provocation too. Maybe the fact that you trust in German police and system has to do with the fact that you're white and male. Yeah, I mean, for non-white people, for Jewish people, Germany, I know in theory that we have a system that is supposed to work, but I know in practice, at every border I want to sort of pass, at every small thing I want to do, that I'm always in trouble, and I'm not young and I'm not male. So if I would be young and male, I really don't know how life is like and with my color. And especially after the NSU, I really think we have no reason to believe in the innocence of the system, because the NSU showed us that part of our constitutional offices are sort of entangled in a very problematic system. We have police that only thing they did was sort of reproducing racism. We had media reproducing racism. So I'm not, I would really enjoy to believe that we have an innocent system, but I can't. So that would be one part of the sort of the answer. The other thing is, I think we always had lost since the 70s. Germany has always had like 8 to 10% of right-wing people, and as long as these parties were, you know, as bluntly stupid as the NPD, I was not really worried, because I would believe that anybody who is like a little bit a Democrat cannot actually vote for somebody like the NPD. So they had these small parties, and they were just like, you know, all 2 to 3%. I was not bothered. The problem now is, and the Reichsbürger, I'm not really bothered about. They're sort of, you know, they are bizarre. But the identitarians are, I think, a big threat, because they are very good in media. They're very good in social media. They're very well educated. They're at universities. So I am worried about them. And I am worried that they are around since 2012, and it took quite some time to actually see that they're around. And they're very clever in being sort of bourgeois racist. Yeah? So the NPD is not bourgeois racist, they are mob racist. But the identitarians are very, as I would say, bourgeois racist. So I think that sort of is a, so they can get to other people. And the AfD, as you said very clearly, is a party that is has a lot of education in there. And they are very bourgeois in everything. And that, I think, is a bigger threat than we had before. So it's not about sort of seeing it more negative or not. I think the situation is quite different than before 2013, because till 2013, we had these small groups and they were fighting each other, and I was quite happy with that, because as long as they were fighting each other, none of them would have more than 5%. But now we have the AfD who's actually sort of a good offer for all these guys and girls, and even the identitarians are actually actively cooperating with the AfD. So I think the difference is that now we have a party that is acceptable for many of these groups. So I do think we will reach 8 to 9% in September, which is a problem.
Thank you.
Right. I mean, the question was going in the same direction as well. I was going to start saying that if you have 8% of citizens in Germany wanting to vote for AfD, you obviously have a problem. And what I think is not as much, I mean, it's true that we have a parliamentary system which is very, very good and makes it more difficult for populists, especially the 5% hurdle, constitutional checks and balances. But at the same time, I think what is dangerous is the development and not necessarily the state. I mean, we should be worried about the future and looking at what is going to happen there. The second thing is also that it's a European trend, and I don't think Germany's shielded away from it just because of our history. Obviously, it's not the same thing as in France where you had a second round, Marine Le Pen, but I would be very, I mean, I try to be more skeptic about the future and looking at what's going to happen there. Concerning the media as well, we have a balanced media, but at the same time, we also have Bild, which is terrible and sexist and you name it. And we also have new developments like RT Germany, which is funded by the Russian government and is definitely post-factual, post-truth and post-factual, as you want to say it. Just one anecdote here as well is the rape case, Lisa. I don't know if any of you have heard of it, which was taken on by AfD. It was complete lies, and people went to the streets to demonstrate. Basically, they said that it goes back to the rape refugees. Apparently, it was a completely fake story that a refugee had raped a little girl, which was named Lisa, in Berlin, and it was taken on by RT Germany especially. And then especially Russlanddeutsche, which are this minority, went to the street saying that we should not accept as many refugees because they're raping our kids. And that happened in Germany, and it was crazy, and I think this kind of development is quite dangerous. And that's it.
Thank you.
So you asked me a very long and winded question, and my answer is very short. Maybe, probably not. So, I really can't imagine a right-wing party on the right of the existing mainstream right-wing party that wouldn't be racist. It is just too attractive to be racist because it's simple. We have the AfD, and parts of the AfD, or some people at the AfD, they pretend not to be racist. It doesn't matter. There will be always racists in a party that is anti-European, that is anti-minorities. I mean, at itself, that is already racist. We have a party like this in power in another country, in Britain, for example. Theresa May, she's very, very right-wing. She is not openly racist, but her policies are racist. I mean, Grenfell Tower, for example, where hundreds of people were deprived of the right to safe housing, is a racist and anti-poor policy. So I think that there wouldn't be hope, the situation wouldn't be better if we have another right-wing CDU, which is anti-European and anti-migration.
Thank you very much. So that's what I get for challenging you. You defeat all my arguments. So maybe I give it now to the audience. Do I see any hands with questions? Yes, the gentleman there. Maybe you start without the microphone. I feel you can project, and then the microphone comes.
My name is Yashar. I was in the Berlin Fellowship. Thanks for your perspectives. It already came up a little bit that
racism is not only a problem within the AfD, but also within the CDU, for example, and the Minister of Interior. And I would go so far to say that racism is a problem within every political party in the German parliament. Even though the left party would say, oh, we're not racist, but still they have some features that are deeply problematic. And I would say that we cannot really overcome these problems as long as the whole German society or the white German society does not come to terms with its deep-rooted racism. And I would ask you how that could maybe happen. So stop focusing on the AfD, but talk about racism in general. How can we achieve that?
Did you address the question to a specific speaker or to?
I would be interested in everything.
Okay. Well, in that case, we collect two more questions to have a group of questions, please.
Okay. Let's rotate two microphones.
Yeah. Thank you so much for your talks. I was a participant in the 2009 program, so I'm a little bit older. And I also have a question that might be a little bit challenging because the AfD actually, it always says that we are not really racist, we are not really right wing, because what we do, what we say, what we want is actually what the CDU wanted in the 80s and 90s. And I sort of, as much as it pains me, I sort of have to agree with that. Because when I was a little kid in the 80s and the 90s, I know that the whole discussion was quite different from today. Just a small example, my father is he was a doctor, and he was working in the emergency room, and then one man came in, he was drunk, and he was hurt by, I don't know, and he didn't want to be touched by my father, and he screamed out in the emergency room something like, "I don't want to be touched by this N-word." And when I tell that to people now, people are shocked because of the whole situation. When I told that to people back then when it happened, people were not shocked, but they were irritated, saying something like, "But why did he call him that? Because, you know, your father is an Afghan, he's not from Africa, why would he call him that N-word?" So seeing as if it would be normal to call somebody that, and so I think, being the optimist that I am, we've come quite far, and I think those people who really hold up the AFD mottos, they're just a small fringe group, too large still, but who sort of don't want to let that die. And so my question would be, again, to maybe some one of you who wants to answer that, do you see that positive change as well, or is that just me because I'm just very optimistic? Yeah, thank you.
So I would say one more question for the first round.
I have a microphone here already.
Oh, you have a microphone. You have an advantage. Thanks. Then you're in the next round, if that's okay, yeah?
Okay. So we'll take this question. Yes. My name is Arda. I'm a fellow in the Amsterdam program. I have a very general question. Several of the previous speakers talked about reaching out across partisan line and to engage in conversation with those who disagree with us. So I'm wondering, where are the right-wing people? It seems to me that we are talking a lot about people rather than engaging with them.
Which is probably less a critique of the panelists than those who invited the panelists, if I understand. Okay. Well, in that case, we can take your question in the first round and then
Hi.
Go back to answers.
I'm Effie. I'm Greek, and I will participate in this year fellowship in Detroit in July. I would like to address, thank you for your talks. I would like to address my question to Mr. Michalski. Mostly about the resumption of the Dublin III regulation, and is it really happening as it pertains to returns to Greece? I mean, has it been implemented yet? And another technical question is about the ban in the family reunification cases in Germany. How did this number come from, the 70 or 60 cases that will be examined? Because my thought was, and in general in Greece, our thought was that Germany was quite friendly with family reunification and relocation. So this came like not a surprise, but a little bit, yes. So thank you.
Great. Thank you for this first round of questions. And I would say we go now with the answers from you, Vince Michalski, to the left, right, depending on how you look at it.
Good, okay, so then I answer your questions before, first. Family unification, yes, I thought also that would be something Germany would be very good at, but they decided at one point, no, we stop it and we make it really, really difficult. At the beginning, it was very slow because they didn't have enough staff in the embassies in the Middle East, but actually... it became part of the policy, and then they changed the law, and it's sad, and it's not right that they do it. And it is against Germany's interest, because families means easier integration and more stabilized families and less crime and all this, because Germany doesn't do it, the risk is very high that we... will have there will be future repercussions. Dublin is a system that was invented to protect Germany from too many refugees, and now the talk of the Minister of Interior a few months ago that the returns to Greece will be taken up again. The regulation exists, but in reality, they don't do it. And that was another show of being tough on foreigners and refugees that they put on. They can't do it because it would be highly illegal under international law. The verdict of the European Court of Human Rights still exists that refugees should not be sent back to Greece because of the appalling conditions in refugee camps there. Shall I answer all questions? Okay. So the gentlemen, where are the right-wing people? Okay, they're not obviously not here, but I come across them every day in my everyday life. The other day, I made a very big mistake. I was at the dentist, and he asked me before he made a huge, terrible operation in my mouth. And waiting till my mouth got numb, he said to bridge this time waiting, he said, "So, Wenzel, have you done anything interesting recently?" And I said, "Yes, I've been to Los Angeles, and I saw banners on the highways with not my president and hashtag resist." And then he started operating my mouth, and he said, "You know, I disagree with these people, and they are only on the West Coast and East Coast, and the rest of the Americans, they're very reasonable people, and he loves Trump, and that he also thinks that democracy is not a good idea, and refugee." So I couldn't say anything. He was, I was in pain, and I agreed very much with him. But I mean, this happens all the time. The right-wing people, they are here. They might even not consider themselves right-wing. And he said also something that worried me a lot, and I heard this again and again from others. He said, "I'm not reading papers anymore. I'm not watching the public television news. I have my own news on the internet." So, you know, these are people who are actually almost lost cases because they can't be reached anymore by non-biased or at least a little bit non-biased news, but they read what they want. The other question was racism everywhere. Yes, you have to address racism everywhere and all the time. And I think it's appalling that politicians have given up on this. We had a few weeks after the gates were open and the refugees came, and we had this so-called welcome culture, which was, of course, a propaganda term. But I think people felt quite great with each other. The economy loved it. The export went up. People liked to buy German washing machines even more than before because suddenly the Germans looked like decent people. And it took the right-wing parties and the right-wing politicians about 6 weeks, they were totally gobsmacked and they couldn't believe what was happening, to react. And then they reacted, and with populist remarks, CDU, CSU, Seehofer, of course, AfD, all these people, and that, you know, it was very fruitful in the sense that people picked it up. So I think you can, as a politician, set good examples and bad examples. And a politician, he should be... I don't even have to finish the sentence. We can fight, and I'm an optimist here as well. Somebody said I'm an optimist. We can fight populism and racism, but we have to do it. And yes, the optimist. Yes, I think also it's better than it was in the 70s and the 80s, and I had teachers who were actually Nazis. Yeah, I mean, they were born and they were still working. They were old, but they were Nazis. And people would talk about gas chambers for people like me wouldn't be a bad idea and all this. This has improved, but it is dangerous to sit back and relax. And Tony Benn, who is a Labour Party leader, who was a Labour Party leader in Britain, said a quite clever, smart sentence. He said that every generation has to fight the same battle. So we have to be very vigilant that we don't turn into a fascist regime.
Right, so that's been said already. Starting with the first question about racism, of course you have racism in mainstream parties, of course you have racism everywhere, just as you have sexism everywhere. I think trying to be constructive or to find solutions, you can either say we're going to have a revolution, destroy the patriarchy, change things, but it's going to be more difficult than trying to have incremental steps. And if you have just been to the cinema to watch Hidden Figures last week, and I think that was, it showed where we're coming from. I mean, in the 60s, there was segregation in the US. Women were allowed to work at the NASA, or if they did, well, they were secretaries. So I think we've come a long, long way in the past few years, and we need to carry on. And I think we have lots of initiatives which are doing great work, such as Black Lives Matter or feminist initiatives. And I think because, I mean, we're at Humanity in Action here, so if people are really committed to do something, it will change. And I think we just need to be a little bit more patient. So that goes to the optimism as well. I think we need to respect people who have conservative values. We won't change them, but maybe we also need to confront them, which means that maybe during your Christmas dinner with a racist uncle, you'd have to say, I don't agree. You don't have to agree. We can agree to disagree, but at the same time, you need to fight for what you think. And if there's something I'd like to say today is that we tend to not be convinced enough about our own ideas. Populists are very convinced about their own ideas, and they're very loud. And maybe we would, if we can learn something from populists, is that we should become a little bit more loud and say that we don't agree with them. It doesn't mean that you will have a full-on blown war, but you can change something by really believing in your own values and thinking that racism is bad and sexism is bad.
To start with a question about racism, I was joking, saying, how many hours do I have to talk on that issue? Because I would say, sort of maybe combine both of your questions. I am somewhat optimistic, somewhat pessimistic, because when I look into especially what is possible today to say about Muslims in Germany, I would have not imagined that a non-right-wing person would have said things like that 10 years ago. So on that way, I'm very pessimistic, because I really feel that one of the major successes of these right-wing parties is that things can be said in mainstream society and nobody actually is, you know, feels a bit irritated by it. So I'm a bit pessimistic on that. But I also was in the cinema and I watched Loving versus Virginia. This is a case of strategic litigation of a very strong black woman in Virginia, I think 1950-something, who fell in love with a white man. And this was a crime in Virginia, but not in the United States. And this film is a very nice love story, but also this is about history of how to fight racism. And I am a fan of strategic litigation. And I think that many of us, and luckily many of us now have the resources to do so, that actually challenge the state and see if what you believe in works out for us, in a sense. And if it's not the state, then literally go to Geneva, to the UN, convention, treaty body, expert groups, or to the European Court of Human Rights to get right, because sometimes I'm really shocked about what happens here and of what we're not doing against it. And I'm optimistic on that thing that I really think some things are not negotiable anymore in the next generation. So if I go to the classroom today, specific words are not negotiable anymore. I remember when I was studying, I had to sort of bear with all sorts of words, and there was no discussion. Today, I don't even have to bear with these words, there is discussion. So it's a little bit of optimism, a little bit of pessimism. What I am really worried about is I think we are falling into the same trap. As I said before, these right-wing parties are clearly racist, and all the prevention against these parties only focused on racism. And now, again, we are only focusing on racism. But for example, Hellersdorf, that's the area where my university is. It's one of the poorest areas in Berlin. I think 30% of the population gets money from the social welfare office, and 25% voted for the AfD. So if these people would actually know that the AfD and understand that the AfD wants to stop social welfare money, I'm quite sure they might not vote for the AfD. Racism is okay for them, yeah? I mean, to be honest, racism is not a big issue. Maybe that's part, now I'll be really cynical, of the German Leitkultur, I don't know. Yeah, that's being cynical. But I'm very sure that somebody who depends on social welfare money can actually not vote for a party who wants to stop any sort of social welfare support. So we were very bad in making visible what their real program is. And I think if we only concentrate on racism, that will not sort of stop people from voting for the AfD. But if you look into what they say about women, it's basically women should go back to the kitchen, have many children, and let the guys work, but not depend on them financially, which is sort of hard to do. So it's either you work or, you know, it's, and sort of these sort of contradictions, and if you look into the anti-feminist statements, it's really interesting because they're so contradictory, like this one. I mean, as a woman, you're supposed not to work, to have many children, but be financially independent. I really don't know how to do that, honestly. So I think it would be very important to focus more also on the non-racist stuff, because I think racism in Germany, unfortunately, gives you the guarantee to win a vote. But these other issues I would like to make more and more visible. So it would be the anti-feminist stuff, the anti-sexual reproductive stuff, and everything that's really clearly social Darwinistic. They have a very clear understanding of who should be supported and who not. So I think we need to concentrate more also on these issues. And talking about racism, I would prefer to concentrate about racism in mainstream society, not only in the right-wing movement.
Thank you. Before we go to the second round of questions, I just want to quickly respond to your comment, you know, why we're not talking about the people, but we're not talking with the people, because I don't want you to feel I just brush it off so easily, because you're hitting on a crucial point. These echo chambers that we talk about, we are also in them. And, you know, if I see who's posting things on Facebook, my Facebook circle of friends, you know, nobody's going to out himself at least as openly as your dentist while he was safe and you couldn't contradict him. And that's a problem. So we're not getting in touch to the people. And the problem is that politics doesn't do it either. And I work with many politicians who admit that they are not taking the grievances seriously that many of the people that vote for those populist parties are having. Instead, they're lecturing them on why they're too stupid to understand that globalization is benefiting them and they just don't see it. The challenge that they're having, and that I think HAA has and many organizations like us do have, is how to get in touch with the right kind of people. And I was in Washington recently, talked to a bunch of Republicans in Congress and in think tanks, and none of them defended Trump. They all said, well, he's not a real Republican, and you know, blah, 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 and now we support him because of party allegiance, blah, blah. And the people who do are alt-right, who are, you know, Pegida demonstrators, when you try to have a decent conversation with them, with some German politicians and public intellectuals try it, it doesn't work, because there's a constant screaming on both sides, and there's not an intellectual exchange of opinions and ideologies. So it is a difficult question that you put your finger on, and I don't think we have a good answer for it. And that's maybe what, and that's why I think what Sophie said is very, very crucial. You know, I'm married to an American whose father voted for Trump, and when I said, well, you know, you go home and, you know, fight him and discuss with him, he said, don't want to ruin Thanksgiving. You know, that's a very natural kind of instinct we all have. Let's not, you know, challenge too many those kind of people. And that's maybe wrong. You know, we have to ruin Thanksgiving and we have to discuss with our racist grandfather and we, you know, we have to kind of go out and say what we disagree with, but also not patronizingly lecture, but also ask the other side to criticize us as openly as we do them.
Maybe I can just add something here. I wanted to answer that question, I forgot, but for instance, in my think tank, we're trying to, and I know lots of, there are initiatives, for instance, social science work, which actually goes to Brandenburg to talk to people or try to just invite them to discussion rounds, but it's extremely difficult. And I think some people in politics realized it, which is good in Germany, so they put money into it to support these kind of initiatives. It's very difficult, but at the same time, it's necessary because not having any kind of dialogue won't help. And I think it will further destroy this kind of trust they have in building up this normative framework, I'd call it, which is very academic, but kind of building this framework where we all have the same kind of base to talk to each other. Because as long as we don't have that and don't trust the same kind of institutions and don't believe in democracy, it will be very difficult to kind of talk to each other.
So two people will have microphones. Can you just get up so I see where you are? And I see many hands, but where are the microphones? That's the first question. Okay. Well, then I would say you and you first. Sorry, you're standing on the wrong side. I'm sorry that I always say you and you. I don't know all your names. So I'm sorry.
Hello. Hi. My name's Emily. I'm the National Director of Humanities in Action Denmark. And I wanted to ask maybe a question that will be a bit tiring for Germans, perhaps, but I will ask it anyway. What is the role of the Holocaust in these right-wing parties? Is it... is it a history that is being utilized? Is it a history that is that they're taking their distance from? And is it a history that is relevant to utilize for the progressives, or is it simply too much of a trope now that the right wing will not listen anymore? I hope I made sense of that question. Thank you.
Is it also directed to all three, or you have just if it is, then it's okay. But if you have a specific person that you want to ask,
I don't have a specific person, but maybe because I don't know your each of your Holocaust history expertise, but anyone who wants to answer.
Hi, I'm Dan. I'm a US fellow from the Copenhagen Fellowship. And my question is about the role of the German economy in either holding back or maybe exacerbating some of these populist movements in the country. Because I think, going back to the US context, not to be too ethnocentric, but it was a big narrative that we heard right after President Trump was elected, that it's the white working class kind of fighting back. And I'm of the belief that that's kind of maybe somewhat of a false narrative, because, I mean, I think it was Van Jones that said it right after Donald Trump was elected. This was a white lash. This was a reaction to having had a black president. This was a racist kind of election that was where the economy was used as a scapegoat. So I'm curious, because some of you said that the German economy has been holding back these movements, and I'm curious if you feel that that is a valid narrative in the German context. Thank you.
Two more questions, maybe. The lady with the golden jacket, which I love, by the way. And then the one question there in the back.
Sorry, guys. Hi, my name is Adiola, and I just had an observation and a question. Listening to the dialogue going on, we keep referencing back to the United States in terms of racism and discrimination. And I just want to bring our attention and also ask a question about the general election in UK, for example. You mentioned Theresa May, and if we put her in comparison with Diane Abbott, what the media did during the election, like, how can we as European come back when we talk about discrimination, racism, and actually point to examples and politicians in Europe and maybe people in Europe, like Christiane Taubira, what she faces as a black woman politician, Diane Abbott, and so many other black women who are politicians in politics, how the media treats them, instead of taking away responsibility and looking to Americans, like we just always we cross above the Atlantic and point to Americans. How can we do that as European and also look home and take responsibilities?
Yes, Gabriela, I'm originally from Greece. You have the word title, in your title, the word nationalism, but I don't think there was enough discussion about national identity, and particularly German identity, and the role that it plays in making some of these populist movements attractive. I know, for example, that Greece is winning a lot of gold medals in an increase of anti-Semitism, xenophobia. A lot of people are welcoming the refugees, but at the same time, they're kind of scared, given the economic situation, of what this is going to be doing to the country. So you're focusing on the case in Germany, but it would have been helpful to contextualize in terms of like what is happening in Europe. Because if we say that, you know, Germany is so racist, and we don't look at what is happening in Poland, in Greece, in Hungary, and I'm not trying to figure out what is happening in Europe, in the world right now, it is a changing country. So would you agree with me that Germany, that West Germany was a kind of multicultural society in the making, East Germany wasn't? They're still trying to make peace with the fact that they are a multicultural society already. There is the dangers of terrorism. There are questions about who is a German, who belongs to the German nation. In what ways this insecurities that these questions and changes promote and provoke play a role in populism? And I find it a little bit dangerous in general if we are going between I am hopeful, I'm not hopeful, because we want to really focus on action. And if it's just simply our mentality and attitude in life that guides action, it can be a bit dangerous. I think it's easier if action is guided by an understanding of history. For example, the way I see that, and I'm talking to the first speaker, if we look around in this room, most of us would have ended in gas chambers 70 years ago. So in a sense, the fact that there is a functioning democracy in this country, and we are discussing this, it's not a paradise, but you can see the same thing and say, we are lucky that we don't have 30% voting for RFD under the changed circumstances, and we only have 9. So the perspective is important, and it can also be dangerous.
So the only question more complicated and more contentious in Germany than to agree on the assessment of the economic situation is to talk about German identity. You managed to ask both. again, 3 minutes to each of you, and we start with you. Sorry.
I'm sorry, I'm really the wrong person to be glad that we only have 9%. I can't sort of, I'm just the wrong person for that, because I do understand that what's happening in Poland is obviously worse, what's happening under Orban is worse. Sure, but I don't think that gives me reason to be satisfied with what the situation is like, because the situation is really changing very sort of, I mean, you can see the changes, you can feel the changes. Just to give you a very small idea, that I've had colleagues of color teaching an anti-racism class like I would have taught before, and then somebody complaining against this person anonymously on Facebook all over, saying she's agitating for left-wing propaganda. And the only thing this person did was to teach an anti-racism class. And then it came out that this guy was very much sort of active in the IFD and so on. So things are really changing. So it is a matter of change that sort of one can feel. But to go back to one of the first questions that we hear about, sort of if it's Joe the plumber or not, right? There has been some research on people who go on the streets on Monday with Pegida, and it's not only Joe the plumber. So it's not people who are unemployed. It's not people who are scared to lose what they have. It's apparently people who have something, but they want more, and they believe that they cannot achieve more because of the immigrants. And that is very interesting, because I would have also presumed that people who vote right-wing or who go on the streets with these parties are more sort of unsatisfied individually. Apparently, from research, we know they are not. So basically, one has to sort of talk about what is this feeling of I can reach the sky, and if I can't reach the sky, it's not because of other reasons, but it's because of the migrants. And I think this phenomenon was firstly very properly explained in this book, I think, White Angry Men, and how white men were actually argumenting not that they did not reach something, but they didn't reach it because it was black women getting it all. So I think that is a very interesting thing we need to look into more depth. And we would need sort of psychologists to look into it. We would need economists to look into it. But I don't have an answer to it. So it's basically your sort of an observation. I think we need to look at more and more. Maybe that's my first.
Right. Yeah, it's very, very difficult questions, I'd say, because they touch upon the most important subject, I'd say, we didn't talk about here. I'd like to combine both the Holocaust question as well as national identity question, because I wanted to say another anecdote is that there was another scandal not too long ago with IFD where one of the party members is in the process of being excluded because he made a comment during a party meeting saying that the Holocaust was a myth and that Germans should stop being so ashamed of their past. So he's in the process of being excluded, but that shows that you have lots of Nazis still in Germany. It's a fact, and I think it's very difficult still to talk about it in the public sphere, which is maybe, it's a good thing it's not accepted publicly, such as other things which might be a bit more accepted, such as sexism or racism. And it also goes back to the idea of national identity. I mean, I was in the train not too long ago, and I saw German flags in front gardens just coming into Berlin. And it gave me a weird feeling because Germans, even of my generation, still have this kind of shame maybe, but it does kind of change and it's a little bit, I'm a bit wary of what's going to happen if you have a strong sense of national identity. At the same time, I'm a political scientist and I've been asking myself lots of questions on these topics because in the end, democracy is based on a people and you need something which puts a political community together. It doesn't need to be anti-diverse. It doesn't need to see the people as one very homogeneous entity. It's not good, but at the same time, it's very difficult to try to find in the future some kind of political community which is not exclusive and is quite diverse, but at the same time makes it work. And that's the question of a nation state, which is another question. The question about the German economy exacerbating populism is also very interesting because it hasn't been as strong as in the US. There's no real anti-trade line in IFD for now, maybe because the economy is fine in Germany. But also what I think is really interesting is that you don't really have a consensus in populist parties about economic policies. I mean, they are most of the time a single issues party where you have either migration or anti-euro, but it's not very much saying either I'm protectionist. I mean, some are the protectionist, but in Germany it's not really protectionist, and I can't really explain why, but it's an interesting topic. As for your comment, I think it was really true. I don't have an answer for it. I mean, I've been following what's been happening in France, and I know it's extremely racist and it's terrible, and I think you would probably need some kind of more shame maybe in the public sphere about these things. I think because of the history in the US, you had more initiatives because you had the whole civil rights movements and things like that, so it's always given as an example, and you had Ferguson, so you have more of this kind of perception in the public sphere, and it's not as much there in Europe, but I still think it's something we should definitely keep on our agenda.
I forgot to comment on the Holocaust question. I think that's very important. As I said before, these two groups, the NPD and the Reichsbürger, they are very clearly sort of positive towards the Holocaust, to say it The AfD is very much bothered to not look as if they sort of, as if they agree to what happened to the, during the Holocaust. But I think they have a very good tactic. They have these people who they don't use the same terminology but the same ideology. So they are very careful on using words that sound sort of as if they were sort of before 1945, but they have a very similar ideology. So I think one of our tasks in the future is going to be to deconstruct that. So they're not using the same words, but like I showed you in this one picture, they're using the same ideology. And obviously it's very difficult to say they are this is actually a Nazi party. But they are using the same sort of systems, the same constructions. I think that would be a very interesting part to sort of deconstruct what they are doing, because it is a very clear sort of political statement, but with new words. So I think we have to look into that more.
Okay. God, these are so difficult questions that I would not like to answer them, but I have to. Let's start with the Holocaust, easiest question. The Holocaust is hanging like a cloud over Germany. It's a weight on everybody's shoulder who's born German, whether Jewish or non-Jewish. And the German identity after 1945 is unthinkable without the Holocaust. And every now and then, the discussions about the Holocaust or kind of substitute discussions pop up, and then it shows what an unrelaxed, really unchilled relationship the Germans have still to this topic. Whether it's in the Germans in this room will know what I mean. It's a documentary which has not been shown and then yes shown, and from all sides the discussion was very heated. Or it's an attack of Arab kids against a Jewish kid. You can't really rationalize this. You can't have a proper conversation about this, and the Germans have to live with that. National identity, I try to answer this very quickly, but let's go back to the early 1900s. No, really. We have 2 minutes. I do it in 2 minutes. So that was when the German first idea of Germany was in the heads of a handful of intellectuals, of students. And Germany only existed since 1871. And since 1871, the idea of German identity wasn't a happy one, to say the least. So I think the real identity in Germany is I'm Bavarian, or I come from the seaside, or I come from the mountains, and Everything else, the German identity, it's an artificial thing, and it really doesn't work. And of course, after 1945, it doesn't work at all anymore. But there was something when I was a student, we called it patriotism, constitutional patriotism. We loved our constitution, which is a human rights constitution. And this kind of expression, I can't really translate it. We called it Verfassungspatriotismus. He doesn't know anymore, see? And Verfassungspatriotismus. And it was something wonderful. And it has kind of disappeared, unfortunately. I think you answered her questions.
Maybe what I want to say is you're just quoting Jürgen Habermas, and it still exists at European level. So the constitutional patriotism, I think, is a good way to maybe fight nationalism.
So unfortunately, we are run over time. Although Antje looked very angrily at me, we started late, to my defense. But we are still finishing now. I know there are more questions in the room, but their email addresses are all public, so you can write them and continue. No, no. Join me in thanking them.
50,000 unread emails.
Okay, join me in thanking them for their participation.